It's Wednesday, October 4th, 2023, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio in the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Kathy Kiley and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, a grim milestone, 6 months now that Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich has been sitting in a Russian prison. We've got another update on that police raid in at the Marion County Record. The police chief has been suspended. We'll talk about what led to that finally. And we're going to talk about the future of the professional organizations that support journalism and help train working journalists, because more than one of them are finding themselves at the brink. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to before our half hour is up today. But I want to start with a smattering of national political stories that seem to just keep bubbling up. Yesterday, Matt Gaetz followed through on his promise to remove Speaker Kevin McCarthy, and it happened. I mean, at first that vote wasn't supposed to happen until today, but I came out of a bunch of meetings and suddenly it was about to happen in that moment.
Yeah, well, I think my guess is that Kevin McCarthy saw the writing on the wall and decided to pull the Band-Aid off as quickly as possible. It was clear what was going to happen. And, you know, the interesting thing about the coverage to me is I saw a couple of pieces this morning, one in the Washington Post and one in the New York Times, by two people who were there when I was there. So they've been longtime hands. And both of them came to the same conclusion. Paul Kane of the Washington Post and Carl Halls of the New York Times talked about how McCarthy just ticked off too many people, and in the end he didn't have enough allies to get him that majority vote. So I think what it really should say to people is the People's House is kind of a mess, but the People's House reflects the people. And I think it really says where we are as a country. And to me, honestly, it goes back to the Tea Party, at least. And I remember covering one of the famous town hall meetings where the Tea Partiers flooded the zone and talking to some of the folks. And one guy said to me, "I don't want to elect anybody who would compromise." And I thought, how are you going to govern a country of 330 million people if you don't compromise? But that's where we are.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, you were saying he ticked off too many people. I mean, all he needed to do was tick off eight, you know.
Yeah.
And that's the sad part about it. I mean,
I think the Democrats, had he not been so brutal to them, he could have gotten some allies there.
This is true. You're right. He would have. And at one point, there was talk that they might come in and save him, because at least they knew what they were getting from McCarthy. Mm-hmm. They have no idea what's going to happen now.
Well, and I think you said it, Ernest. They knew what they were getting, and that's why they didn't come in to save him, because time and time again, he kept pulling the football away. You know, every time they thought they had a compromise, they had a deal, he would renege on it, in part because he kept pandering to this group of eight that in the end turned on him.
But I think that goes back to what you were talking about, this sort of being driven by the factions at the margins.
Exactly.
That continue to say, we will not compromise on anything. If a Democrat backs it, I'm not going to vote for it. If a Republican backs it, I'm not going to vote for it. And you're right, you can't govern like that. And now here we are, what, 2 weeks, 3 weeks away from another shutdown?
A little bit more. We're down to what, like 39
days? Well, I'll tell you what, it's going to happen right as people are trying to travel for Thanksgiving.
Yes. They kept saying 45 days over the weekend. I just kept thinking, yeah, just in time for Thanksgiving. And at the same time, we have not only the now again looming government shutdown, but there's no leadership actively in the House leading, at least for another week, until they can restart and have the conference put somebody up and have a vote again. And are we looking at another 15 rounds of votes?
Right. And here's the sad part about it. I was listening to some of the coverage this morning. I even think that the news media, national news media, is sort of like,
Ernest just made a face looking forward, kind of dumbfounded, not sure where to go. I'm going to help our radio audience know where he's going with that. We're going to describe that.
Right. We can't, you know, it's like we don't have any other narrative that we can tell. We've said constantly over and over and over again. We've covered this in so many ways, but we keep coming back to the same place, which is basically goes back to what you were talking about, which we are a polarized nation that can't get its act together because we won't even sit at the same table.
Right. When you have voters saying, I don't want to vote for someone who's going to compromise, this is what you get. Congress means come together. And what you used to see in Congress were people who had genuine ideological differences, came from different parts of the country, but they would come together, get to know each other, and walk a mile in the other person's shoes, and then figure out a way that they could make a deal. But it has been punitive to do that now. That is verboten. And I think the voters have to look at inside themselves. And, you know, I got a text today from a friend who sent me a link to some online piece. And the headline was, "This will make your blood boil." And I sent a note back to the person and said, you know, when you get something online like that that said, "This will make your blood boil," ask yourself, why does somebody want to make your blood boil?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I really think, you know, the media platforms have been peddling polarization. And I really do believe that a lot of that is pushed by enemies of the real enemies of the people who are using social media as a vector for propaganda and disinformation.
But I also think it's being pushed by those who can make a profit from it.
And, you know, found myself falling down that rabbit hole last night is, you know, friends are sharing links back and forth as well with all of the memes, right? I don't know if you've seen the photo of Kevin McCarthy when he was standing there with his, like, pointing up at his name over the House Speaker sign that now it's been replaced by a Spirit Halloween store sign.
Wow. Right. Like, not really,
right, exactly. But this Photoshop. Idea of the web memes, and you talk about trying to profit off of it. Like, that's not funny, given how, like, Spirit Halloween sucks into every vacant retail space an hour after it becomes vacant in August.
Right. I mean, that's the thing that I think gets lost in this, because we talk about this polarization from a political standpoint and what it's doing to the fabric of the country. But there are very active constituencies out there who are all about making a profit. They don't care whether it's coming from the right or the left, as long as it keeps going, because as long as it's going, they're making money.
Mm-hmm. Right. Hate sells. Yeah. And the American public has fallen for it. And unless and until voters give their elected representatives the mandate to compromise, this is going to keep happening.
Right. Okay, so this isn't all that's going on. While journalists are covering this in Washington, there's still a presidential election that's being run with a wide field of candidates trailing the now gag-ordered Donald Trump for their party's nomination. Kathy, you convinced me to watch the first debate. Last week's debate, it was on TV, but I had kind of zoned out for my own reasons. And you kind of came back at me and told me you've got some pretty serious thoughts on this.
Yeah, I watched the second debate, and, you know, it struck me. I don't think the Republicans are doing themselves any favors by giving Fox the monopoly on these events. And the reason is, in both cases, the candidates just got away with saying things that I thought were just not going to fly in a general election. In both debates, they were asked about environment, and in both debates, every single Republican candidate doubled down on fossil fuels and fracking. And this comes without any kind of, I know, look at Ernest's face. He can't believe it.
We need to do a
montage of Ernest's faces on the website. But my point is, in any other forum, they would have been challenged. You know, somebody would have said, well, what about the summer we just went through? And what about the deluge in New York and the wildfires in Hawaii?
And the fact that it's still 90 degrees in Missouri in October.
Yes. I mean, what about all that? But nobody did. And the one person in the second debate who kind of countered it, and she got slammed on social media for doing it, was the woman from Univision. I'm blanking on her name, but she was asking questions about immigration, very pointed and challenging some of the underlying assumptions. But honestly, hello, there's going to be a general election. And unless you're ready for the questions and you're ready for the constituency, it's game over. I just can't imagine young people being satisfied with the answers on climate that these Republicans gave.
But are you surprised? I mean, really, are you surprised?
Yeah,
because
they,
I mean, if you think about it, from the end of the Trump presidency to now, everything has shifted toward involving the Republicans. Everything has shifted towards, is Donald Trump going to be able to hold on to power, and is he going to be the nominee for the Republican Party in 2024? And that's one narrative. And the other is there someone else out there? And that's all they've been talking about.
Well, to that point, I think the questioning from the Fox panels have made it more difficult for any of those candidates to stand out, because the debate, the questioners don't want to ask any tough questions about Donald Trump because they're afraid of alienating their audience. So the kind of questions that might actually elicit the responses that could cause voters to see a contrast just aren't getting asked.
Yeah. I mean, and I don't see that changing. I think the only variable that could change that would be what happens in court. Is he going to be convicted in one of these in one of these trials that he's in now? And it may only take one. And if it takes one, then all of a sudden that narrative has to change, because now I don't even think the Republicans themselves could fathom electing a convicted person to the presidency or the nomination.
Okay. So there's been all this goofiness going on in D.C., with the presidential campaign. And it's not just on the right. Last week, there were headlines flying about the indictment and not guilty plea of Democratic Senator Bob Menendez. This one's different, though. And here I want to let you listen in to a journalist who is not covering the story. Her name, Alicia Melendez.
We have a lot to get to tonight, but I want to begin on a personal note. Last week, a grand jury indicted U.S. Senator Bob Menendez. This past week, dozens of members of his own party have demanded his resignation. I have been watching along with all of you as a citizen and also as his daughter. I will not be reporting on the legal case. That said, my colleagues across MSNBC and NBC News, they have aggressively covered this story and they'll continue to do so, as they should.
Now, that's a disclaimer we never heard from Chris Cuomo over at CNN.
That's right. And I commend her and I commend MSNBC for coming out front and saying, hey, this is the way we're going to handle this.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting to me is that a sort of a collaboration between Menendez and the network she works for? Or did she walk into her boss's office and say, hey, I want to go on the air and state unequivocally that I will not be involved in the coverage?
And that's the one part of this is outsiders. We're never going to know where or how that line was drawn. I have to wonder and ask you, she has a weekend show. Does it become a little bit easier when it's a weekend show with somebody who's on the air a couple of hours on a weekend to say, it's okay, you sit this one out, we understand how and why, as opposed to your primetime guy who's bringing in the viewers at night like Chris Cuomo was?
Well, you know what? I don't think it really matters.
Okay.
Because I think there are ways you could handle that. You mm-hmm. certainly could have handled it better than CNN did in the Cuomo case. And even if you have somebody who's the main anchor on a show, I think what she did was really great. It was elegantly done. It was straightforward. It was right out there. I'm his daughter. I'm not going to cover this. People can understand that. If the Menendez story, if a big story in that case breaks over the weekend, you just bring in somebody else to do that story. And that's what
and
should have been done at CNN.
Talent, and there's got to be some other talent
Absolutely.
Who's in the newsroom or can easily be like, okay, we're going to go to a quick commercial break, and you come back to the other person.
Exactly.
We have breaking news.
100%.
That.
Yeah.
We passed a pretty grim milestone on Friday. It's been 6 months since Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich was taken hostage in Russia. His mother appeared with Anderson Cooper a few days ago. I want us to take a listen to how she describes how she's maintaining contact with him weekly through letters.
We didn't speak to him that often when he traveled, and now we speak to him once a week, which is very nice. It's like ongoing conversation.
So you were able to speak to him through letters, or can you
through letters?
Through letters.
Yes.
Through are you able to speak on the phone at all?
No. Only he's in Lefortovo. It's only letters. Letters are read, censored, but we write to him. And it's like sitting on the couch. The only thing that the answer comes the following week.
It's gut-wrenching in its relative innocence about how sweet it is. A mother who's writing 10-page letters to her son, telling stories, sharing what's gone on in the week, having conversations that take a week to follow up for the other side.
Yeah, this I met this couple when they were in Washington at the National Press Club a few weeks ago, and I just have to tell you, I lost it. They are such nice people, and the fact that they've been through this, they had to leave the Soviet Union because of their religion, and now to have to go through that, and now to have their son back in custody, it's just... it's heartbreaking, and the very least I think we as journalists can do is hold up Evan Gershkovich's name. I think the other thing we can do is do what Mrs. Gershkovich is doing, and that is write. There is a way to write to Evan, and his parents get to see that, and I think his jailers get to see it too, which is probably
because
a good thing.
Because they're censored.
Yes, and you can go on to the Wall Street Journal website. There's a part of it that's in front of the paywall, and there's a form you can use to write a note to the Gershkovich family, and that form was designed by one of our graduates, Madison Conti of the Missouri School of Journalism. So I really recommend that people do that. I think it's really important to let Evan know he's supported, to let his parents know he's supported, and also to let the Russian government know he's supported.
Yeah, I would hope that. I mean, things have been sort of since the event in Washington, things have been relatively quiet on the diplomatic front. I would hope that there are things happening in the background that will lead to his release. I mean, at this point we just don't know.
Yeah, it's a very difficult situation. And there are people, I think, who get very frustrated. Yeah. They say, well, why do people put themselves in danger? But I think, and of course, President Biden got a big blowback when he negotiated the release of hostages from Iran. And that's a hard thing to do. But if a journalist doesn't go in, then
we don't
the
ever
truth
know what's
doesn't
happening.
we don't have eyes there. So this is just a brutal situation.
Well, and so we also can't let this week go by without acknowledging the 5-year anniversary of the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, who was he was killed while in the Saudi embassy in Istanbul. Some opinion pieces in the Washington Post this week saying very, very adroitly that there has been no justice and no closure here.
Yeah, and you know, I keep going back. There was a photograph a couple weeks ago from the G20 of President Biden shaking hands with MBS, who's our own intelligence services. The Saudi leader has been triggered as the murderer here, the guy who ordered the murder. And to see our president shaking hands, and in the background, by the way, Narendra Modi, the Indian prime minister, who's also trying to silence journalists. So, when will we ever learn as Americans that playing these supposed realpolitics games, we never win? We never win. It's like Kevin McCarthy trying to cozy up to Matt Gaetz. The bullies are never going to cut you a break. So why even bother playing to them? It's just maddening.
Yeah.
So speaking of the bullies, we have another bit of incremental news to bring folks up to date with, an update from Marion County, Kansas. 6.5 weeks ago, the police raided the Marion County Record and the homes of some of its staffers. And 6 weeks after the warrants permitting those raids were rescinded, the mayor has suspended Police Chief Gideon Cody. Now, the suspension was announced via email from the city administrator to city council members. Interestingly enough, something learned through Sunshine Act, Freedom of Information Act requests, The vice mayor did not get one of those emails. And also, interestingly enough, her home was among those raided. Now, there's some doubt, perhaps, that maybe an email address was wrong. But we have this suspension now. But we're learning about it all through records requests.
Yeah, it's, I think we said back when this first happened, this is a really Phyllis Payton place. It's a small town drama. And there's obviously a lot of, undercurrents that we don't appreciate. But I think for us as journalists, the important thing is this effort to get to who the sources were has been called out. And for the paper, justice has been done. Now, for the editor and publisher, Eric Meyer, his mother died a day after the raid.
Right.
I mean, she was in her 90s, but still,
police show up at your house and you're not raid your house. I mean, that you can't. He's saying that that contributed to her passing away, and there may be some truth to that you don't know. But to me, I mean, the at first they said they weren't going to suspend him until the Kansas Bureau of Investigation completed the work that they were doing. That hasn't happened yet.
Yeah.
Then they turn around and they suspend him. Everything here is just strange. And I think, what's going to happen is we're going to find out a lot more once that investigation is done.
I think that's absolutely right.
Because it's really good. I think it's going to expose that there may have been something on the part of that police chief against the newspaper and maybe others that led to all of this.
Yeah, and don't you think, Ernest, that given the way this is unfolding, that somebody at the Kansas Bureau of Investigation had to have said to the mayor, you might want to get rid of this guy now.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So okay. They know something.
Yeah.
So before we go, I want to talk about an announcement that was made late last week at the Society of Professional Journalists conference that was held in Las Vegas. And that big announcement was that there won't be a conference again next year, that the organization is struggling financially. And despite there being high demand among its membership to continue to have conferences such as this one, where there can be ongoing training and continuing education for its members, the money isn't there to support this kind of training. And this seems like such a sign of the times, that we're in a moment where corporations that own news organizations are pulling the purse strings even tighter, and that one of those first things to go is training. And at the same time, salaries aren't high enough for people to go and seek out this kind of continuing education and further training and networking on their own. So we end up with this void.
Yeah, it's interesting because I was at a smaller conference last week when this news, when the SPJ news came out. And even at our conference, our small journalism historians, we were discussing the same issue about how difficult it is to have these national conferences where you do that networking and you talk about issues and there is training there. It's difficult to do that because of the cost of the hotels, the cost of the travel, the cost of the food. I mean, all of that becomes an issue when you're talking about an SBJ, which has thousands of members.
Worldwide,
those conferences are even larger and they're much more costly. The one issue that kept coming out of that conference was how there was a lack of transparency on the part of those who run the organization about just how much debt they had incurred over the years by not taking care of and making sure that people understood this is how much it costs to have these conferences and we're going to need to align that with how much money we're bringing in. And they're saying if that had been done, then maybe they could they might not be in the financial trouble that they're in now. So just the lack of transparency is really something that the membership is upset about.
Never put a journalist in charge of the Treasury. That's all I'm going to say. But no, I would also say that, this is what you brought up, Amy, and the lack of training opportunities at a time when it's needed more than ever is really difficult. And I think we have to get more imaginative. You know, the what Ernest was describing, the era of the big conference, that's over, because a lot of those big conferences used to be underwritten by news organizations.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And the travel was paid for by news
by
organizations.
By your employee, if you were working
right,
for them.
Right, but more and more, you're on your own. And, you know, a lot of journalists don't make that kind of money. So I think, you know, there are a number of these organizations, as I think you alluded to at the top. There are several who are also in a similar situation. And, you know, I do think the SPJ made a good move there, as painful as it had to be. I really think some of these organizations should get together. They all do different things, but kind of say, this year is your turn to do the conference, and next
or
year
you
is
can go back, you can go back to the regional. You can
right.
go back
okay,
to the
so
regional
you talk
conferences.
About regional.
So the SPJ.
Let's go to regional, and then we'll talk about Unity.
Right. SPJ, for the longest mm-hmm. time, had regional conferences. Mm-hmm. And I think that that might be a stopgap until they can figure out what they want to do on a national level.
Because you drive 3 hours. You don't have to fly to wherever.
Exactly.
It can be in a moderately priced city because you go for 2 or 3 days.
And you
days.
Don't have to stay for as many days.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you center it around training.
Yes.
As opposed to everything else that happens with these conferences. I think that's probably one of the ways that they can go as a stopgap measure
yeah.
until they can figure out what they want to do.
Because,
nationally.
You know, that other idea of the whole, like, Zoom conference, the thing that really you get out of the conference is the opportunity to network with others
exactly.
and brainstorm yeah. about people going through some of the same things. And, Kathy, you were mentioning the idea of organizations coming together and having a more large-scale conference and kind
or
of alternating.
Taking turns.
Okay,
yeah.
So in that vein, Ernest, talk for a minute about Unity and what Unity was doing in the early to mid 2000s, because it was a model that was tried that maybe didn't work out so well.
Yeah, the Black Journalists Association, the Hispanic Journalists Association, and the Native American
right.
Would meet mm-hmm. and have Unity conferences. If I remember correctly, they were doing it on a every 3 year
yeah.
basis or something like that. And that was one way in which to have these big conferences mm-hmm. that national sponsors would sponsor because you could reach a larger audience
with
and you could do
conference.
One exactly and you had that networking and you had that training. So in that case, that was very important. One of the problems with Unity is getting the organizations to work together or feel as if they're all doing it, because what happens is that one organization is larger than the other, and then you have a lot of lack of transparency and inviting and other things. So, you know, again, Unity is an answer, but I don't think it's going to be the answer. They're going to have to really search at how they want to do this.
Okay, well, we are just about out of time for this week's show. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about each of the topics that we talked about today. You can find all of that information and some of that background reading on our links blog. You can find that under both the programs tab and the podcast tabs at kbia.org. We're also available wherever you get your podcast downloads. That feed is up and running and updated weekly, including you can find that in places like iTunes and Spotify, Stitcher. Like us on Facebook. We're active there. You can follow us on X, which is formerly known as Twitter. Our handle on X is @viewsonkbia. Each of these are great ways to watch and listen to the program again, leave comments, questions, see previews of what we will be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJ Ice, Travis McMillan for directing today's show, to Takiya Thomas for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music. Nate Brown is our social media manager. And I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join Ernest and I next week when we're here with Nick Matthews for another edition of Views of the News.